he was at that moment could manage to reach the broken window above, and if somehow, by dumb luck, he managed it, what could he do? Abby was the smart one. She was the brilliant scientist, the physicist who designed whatever it was they did in Pierce Tower. Fatigue and fear fed the parasite. Confusion and doubt gave its voice a special clarity. David stood there on the edge of the building, watching the real world go mad. Tears burned in the corners of his eyes, and he had to push the goggles up to wipe them away. His head felt like it was split in half. Gasping, he blinked his vision clear. Then he stood there, blasted by the night wind, listening inside for the parasitic voice, but now there was only silence. He frowned because it was so strange. Why that voice? Why now, after all these years?
"What's happening to me?"
he asked the troubled night. The city of New York was burning, crashing, dying. It had no time to answer his questions. David took a long breath to steady himself, then needed to take five more until some actual measure of calm took tentative hold.
"Don't you go losing your shit," he told himself.
And slowly, carefully, he began to climb again. Chapter 8. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The hunter stood before the closed fire tower door, chest heaving from exertion, fists balled into knuckly knots. The pack of hounds crouched around her, snarling, snapping at the doors as if they could bite through it, slashing with their claws. The steel was crisscrossed with deep gouges. It was also dented from the hunter's armored fists, but the door held. The hunter drew back her hand to hit it again, more out of frustration and rage than with any hope of breaking through, but a sound made her stop. She turned, and the hounds turned with her. There were bodies, none whole, strewn across the floor. The coppery stink of blood permeated the air. She flicked on her thermal scans, and they painted one lens of her helmet with an overlay showing several people hunkered down behind the machinery. One of them had made that furtive noise, but it was not a threatening sound. They were hiding from her. Not immediate threats, and therefore only a distraction. Nothing else seemed to move except for the centipede, which was sucking up spilled blood. Drops of its saliva plopped down, hissing as they made contact. The thing's spit was laced with acid, and it was beginning to eat into the floor itself. The hunter still held her lance in her left hand, though she'd retracted it down to a club. As she surveyed the room, her thumb rested on the button, ready to extend it. On the inside of her left lens, the helmet's sensors fed her information. Everything seemed still. Dead. Beyond the centipede, the threshold was continuing to cycle through the infinity of Earths. Most were completely new, even to the hunter, who'd walked through so many, many worlds. A few, though, repeated, those key worlds. One world that was the height of civilized development, with elegant towers made from green porcelain that rose to the skies like the fingers of a god of beauty. A world where music rode the winds and the seas were as clear as pale blue and green crystal. Or had been so. Now those towers were cracked and broken and filled with dust, and the rivers running from those lovely cities were now choked with corpses and polluted with the diseased blood of the billions who had died. Another world was barren, its atmosphere ripped away, taking with it all life and all beauty, leaving only desolation so complete that no one survived even to mourn it. One world was forever shrouded in darkness, its skies choked with clouds, from which radioactive snow drifted down on the twisted and sightless wrecks of the pitiful few survivors. There was a world overrun with beasts whose bodies seemed unfixed, unstable. They morphed and changed. Now they were humans with golden skins, and now they were slavering creatures with 1,000 teeth. And there was one world
crushed beneath the weight of creatures of such vast power, such incomprehensible strangeness, that the sight of them drove the people mad. Now that world was populated with the insane, all of whom had become worshippers of creatures. Perhaps they were gods, from beyond the known stars. On and on, cycling through the genetic possibilities of evolution that had been broken by trauma and driven mad by 10,000 years of war. The hunter had been to all of those worlds, and many before. Hunting, always hunting, for her. And now, here, in a world unbroken, the hunter had found her. Abby Corman, a creature so vile that saying her name was an act of transgressive blasphemy. It was an obscenity in the mouths of parents grieving for children born as genetic freaks or hideous lumps of quivering inhuman flesh. She who had been called the mother of none because all that she had given birth to was destruction and death. She was here, in this world. And the hunter was blocked by a door, a simple door. Why had the witch made the door so strong? Had this destroyer foreseen her own doom and built this gateway as a trap? Had she known she was being hunted and set a snare? The hunter looked at the threshold. Maybe. The only way out of this room was back through the endless doorway. But retreating now was a defeat. No, she murmured. Her fist tightened around her lance, and she almost used the weapon to lash out at the door. Then she paused and looked more closely at the centipede, at the drops of acid falling from its mouth, at the deep burns in the floor. Beneath the mask, the hunter smiled. Chapter 9. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. They crept down the stairs, slowly, quietly. To Abby, it sounded like they were making too much noise. Even the thump of her heart and the rasp of her breath seemed to be thunderous amid the concrete walls of the stairwell. It was like fleeing through an echo chamber. The levels they'd passed were quiet. Any staff who routinely worked there would have been in the gateway chamber for the firing, but they were just above the 53rd floor, where systems analysis was located. Those specialists would have been required to be at their workstations when the machines fired. Massive amounts of raw data would have flooded down to them from the thousands of sensors in the chamber. Halfway down the stairs, a sound froze them all in place. It was a cell phone, and it was ringing. "Whose is it?" snapped Abby, but they all shook their heads.
"I thought all cell services were blocked when the building went into lockdown," said Jiwoo.
"It was," said Rosa, "but a whole bank of windows was blown out in the gateway chamber, shutters and all. Maybe that's how the cell signal is getting through."
"God, I hope so," said Abby as she took another few steps down.
She cocked her head to listen, trying to find the source amid the echo chamber distortion.
"It's down here. It's somewhere on the landing, I think."
The ringing stopped before they'd taken more than a couple of steps, and then it started again.
"There it is," said Rosa, pointing past her, and they all hurried down to the landing on the 53rd floor and froze.
There was a Motorola cell in a pink otter case on the floor near the fire door. The screen was cracked, but the ringer still worked. However, as Rosa reached for it, the call went to voicemail, and the ringing cut off. Even so, Abby caught Rosa's wrist and pulled her hand away.
"Don't touch it," she warned.
"Why? What's—" But Rosa's words faded out. As the others gathered around, they saw it too. There was something smeared over the phone. It was clear, but with a faint yellow tint to it.
"What is that?" asked Burke.
I don't know," admitted Abby.
Jiwoo squatted down and then bent forward to sniff it.
"It smells like plant sap."
The sticky goo was splattered in heavy drops on the concrete landing as well,
and as they followed the line of it, it was immediately apparent it was smeared on part of the door as well.
"What is that?" breathed Riley. "I mean, why would there be plant sap all over the place?"
No one had an answer for that. Instead, they looked at the closed door. Rosa and Jiwoo leaned close to it, listening for several long moments, but then they shook their heads.
"Can't hear anything," said Jiwoo.
"That's good, though, isn't it?"
asked Burke. Even though he was the biggest of all of them, he was drenched in fear sweat.
"If the phones are working," began Rosa.
"Then maybe we should call someone in there first," finished Abby.
"Smart."
"My cell's dead," said Burke.
"It overheated like a son of a bitch when Sloan fired the gateway."
"Mine too," said Jiwoo, and the others nodded.
Abby straightened and pulled hers out. She hadn't been there when the lockdown process was launched.
"I've got bars," she announced,
her excitement overriding her need to be quiet. She knew she should call David, 911, and anyone who might be able to help, but all of that could wait for half a minute. She pulled up her contacts, found the number for Karen Kratz, the data supervisor, and hit call. It was the phone on the floor that began to ring.
"Shit," said Abby, ending the call.
"What's that mean?" asked Burke.
"To hell with this," growled Abby and punched 911.
Rosa pressed her ear to the other side of the phone, and the rest leaned in. They listened to it ring and ring and ring. Then the call just ended. No pickup, no voicemail message. It just stopped.
"That's weird," murmured Abby.
"Try it again," prompted Jiwoo. "Might be interference from the threshold."
She tried it again. Another series of rings and then silence. Abby tried one more time. Same result.
"Does that mean whatever's happening here is out there too?"
asked Burke, his voice quavering.
"It's interference from the threshold," insisted Jiwoo.
Abby did not comment on that. Instead, she placed a call to a different number. It rang twice, three times, four. And then a voice said,
"Abby?"
"Oh my God," she cried. "David!"
Chapter 10. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The elevator never arrived. Arnold Benjamin looked around at the other three survivors. As far as he knew, the four of them were the only ones to have made it out of the gateway chamber alive. Through the closed steel security door, he could hear those freakish animals snarling and screaming. Were they dogs? Cats? There were other kinds of screams, too, but Benjamin forced himself not to hear those. He could not afford to put names to each shriek, or worse, faces. No way. No goddamn way. He felt terribly alone. Chan, Broussard, and Sloan were out of it. Hurt, or just plain out of their freaking minds.
"I need to get out."
That thought pounded in Benjamin's head.
"This isn't my fault, and I need to get the hell out of here right now."
He looked up and down the short hallway. There wasn't much. The fire stairs were on the other side of the chamber, behind the massive tree trunk. There was a closet at the end of the hall, but it was janitorial. Mops and brooms weren't going to be of any use against that armored freak, and certainly not against those reptilian animals.
What did that leave?
He swept everything with his eyes, floor to ceiling, and then he stopped. And he smiled. At the opposite end of the hallway, past a pair of vending machines, was a grill screwed onto the wall. Air ducts. He'd hardly thought those words before he was running, skidding to a stop in front of the grill, digging into his pockets for something that might work as a screwdriver. Then realized he didn't need one. The grill was held in place by four small wing nuts, one in each corner. They were hard to turn. The metal wings tore at the pads of his fingers, but Benjamin had clever fingers, and he was scared. And those two things gave him the strength and leverage to work them off. 1, 2, 3, 4, done. The grill dropped to the floor with a clang. Benjamin threw a look over his shoulder, seeing Chan and Broussard glance sharply at him. Sloane was now propped up on her elbows, looking blearily at him too. The others helped her to her feet, and she took a few shaky steps toward the vent.
"Arnold?" Sloane called uncertainly. "You found a way out. Thank God. Take me with—"
But Benjamin did not hear the rest. He was already inside the vent and crawling like a madman through the ducts. Sloane's scream of outraged betrayal chased him through the shadows, but he could not afford to hear that either. Chapter 11. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The hunter stalked toward the centipede. Her pack followed, and the youngest abruptly lunged ahead, teeth bared as it hurled itself at the prey.
"No!" roared the hunter, but the command was a second too late.
The hound slammed into the insect and bore it down, rolling over and over with it in a snarling and savage tangle of teeth and mandibles, claws and spiked legs. The hunter rushed forward, screaming commands. That 1 second was all it took for the centipede to spit its acid venom into the young hound's face. The young creature screeched in towering agony and flopped sideways, falling hard to the floor as smoke curled up from its eyes and snout. The flesh boiled away to reveal white bone, and yet the hound was alive. Pitiably, agonizingly alive.
"No, please, no,"
gasped the hunter as she dropped her spear and knelt to gather the dying creature in her arms. The acid seared her armor, but she didn't care. The blind young hound whimpered in pain and confusion, and with what was left of its tongue tried to lick the hunter's hand. The other hounds circled and whined in helpless fury as the centipede scuttled away to continue feasting on the dead lab technician. The hunter drew a slender knife from a thigh sheath and placed the tip over the young hound's brave heart.
"I'm sorry, my sweet," she said,
and then slipped the blade through hide and muscle and into the fluttering heart. The hound relaxed in her arms and was forever still. All around the room, the other 9 hounds threw back their heads and uttered a howl so loud, so filled with sorrow that it threatened to crack the ceiling of heaven. The hunter touched her forehead to the dead hound's head, then laid it carefully on the floor. As the hunter rose, her fists balled with pain and hatred. She strode over to the centipede and caught it as the monster tried to scuttle away. She straightened, holding it in one gloved hand. The creature was enormous, weighing 50 or 60 pounds. It curled and writhed, trying to clutch with its many spiked-tipped feet, but the hunter's armor was too thick. Then it spat at the hunter, and wherever the droplets landed, the protective shell immediately began to steam as acids melted the surface of the complex alloys. But the hunter did not let go. Instead, she flipped up a hinged flap on her right gauntlet and pushed a few exposed buttons. Immediately, the surface of the armor changed color, becoming a livid red as chemicals were released by the sensors. The acid was neutralized within seconds. She bent to retrieve her spear. The pack snarled and yipped around the hunter's legs as she walked the centipede over to the locked fire tower door. A small movement of her thumb extended the spear point of her weapon, and the hunter slashed the wriggling creature. The finest scalpel could not have made a cleaner or quicker cut. Blood that reeked of acid poured out, and before it could drip to the floor, the hunter raised the creature, slapped it against the door, and then rubbed the burning liquid over the hinges and the reinforcing steel bolts.
"You killed my dog, you worthless piece of shit," she said coldly. "At least in death, you can be useful."
Noxious steam curled upward as the door metal ran like mercury. Chapter 12. The Pierce Tower, the climb.
"Abby," cried David,
Abby, are you okay?
He stood with his feet braced on a narrow lip of concrete, the rope taking most of his weight, a lost arrow piton in his other hand, ready to slot into place. The wind was increasing, almost blowing a gale, even though the sky was clear of the storm clouds that had battered the city until the last pulse. When his phone began ringing, he almost ignored it, but then realized it could be his sister. He never expected it to be Abby.
David, thank God. Where are you? Asked Abby. I tried calling 911, but there was no answer.
Abby, are you okay?
He repeated, making himself say it slower, pulling the fear and desperation from his voice.
I'm okay, she said.
What happened in there?
Sloan and Benjamin turned on the... I mean, they did something stupid. The building's in lockdown and we're in trouble. Oh, David, we need to get out of here. Where are you?
He almost smiled.
Right now, I think I'm on the 40th floor, or rather, outside of it.
What?
After that pulse, I couldn't get in, so I went home and got my climbing gear. There's a broken window and I'm climbing up to it.
You're climbing the outside of the building?
Yes. Where are you? What the hell is happening?
It's hard to explain, she said,
and David could hear the fracture lines in her voice.
I don't think you'd believe me.
David laughed, a short, hard bark of laughter that was totally without mirth.
I'm pretty sure I would. I think whatever is happening in there is happening out here. Tell me, babe. Let me know how I can help you.
Chapter 13 The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. Abby told David everything, as much as desperation and need allowed. Concerns over security clearance, even at ultra-top secret levels, somehow didn't matter a damn anymore. She told him about the Gateway Project, the project intended to open up stable thresholds between this Earth and the infinite number of potential parallel worlds, and how they thought they'd found one that was uninhabited, but lush with natural resources that could be harvested or mined. Precious metals, building materials, food sources, all of it. She told him about the safety trial run she'd wanted to conduct, and the need for weeks or months of data analysis afterward, and the danger of trying to open a threshold for too long before that data could be exhaustively studied. She told him about the senators who'd been there, and how Dr. Benjamin was afraid Abby had spooked them so much with her fetish for safety that he fired her, and how he brought in Dr. Sloan, a discredited scientist who'd been part of the last catastrophic attempt to open a threshold at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. She told him that Sloan and Benjamin had bypassed the testing phase because her boss wanted to prove the system worked before the senators could shut things down for a review. She told him that the threshold had, in fact, been opened, and although the physical doorway was stable, it was somehow channeling dozens or even hundreds of other Earths, about how there was a collision of parallel worlds. And she told him about the hunter and the pack of reptilian hounds. She said all of this in a rush, spending more time than she wanted to, but aware that David needed to understand. He needed to know the scope of things. There was a silence on the line so deep that she said, David, are you still there?
Yes,
he said, yelling to be heard over the sound of a strong wind.
Whatever's happening in there is happening out here. And it's bad, babe. It's really fucking bad.
What? Out there? She cried. But that's impossible. The threshold is inside the chamber. It's sealed like a Faraday cage. It can't have gone past the walls.
Even as she said it, Abby knew David was telling the truth. There was something down on the ground floor making those rasping sounds, and there was the weird, smelly plant sap right here on Karen Kratz's cell phone and the door to the analytics floor.
It's happening out here, David repeated. Trust me.
He told her very quickly about the fires, the collapsing buildings, and the monster birds.
Oh my God, are you okay? Please tell me you are, she begged.
I'm good. Now tell me what you need me to do, he said. You call the play and I'll get it done.
What floor is the broken window on?
Top floor. Why?
God, David, you can't go up there. It's not safe. That's where that hunter thing and her beasts are.
Which is when Abby realized that she no longer heard the hunter pounding on the door. She turned slowly. They all did, and looked up the stairs. From the landing, they couldn't see anything. She smelled something, though. An acrid burn in her nostrils. A chemical stink that made her eyes water.
What the hell's that?
Demanded Burke, wincing and pawing at his eyes.
Acid, said Riley.
What? Demanded Abby and Jiwoo at the same time.
It's acid, repeated Riley. Nitric acid, I'm sure of it. Oh, Jesus God. I think that thing's using some kind of acid on the door.
Then they heard a heavy whump as something heavy crashed down above them. The door. It had to be. Then a scuff, as if a shoe or boot brushed a stair. Then the soft, heavy noise of something moving on padded feet. At the end of each step, there were little sharp sounds, the kind of sounds claws might make on the metal steps.
Oh my God, gasped Abby. They're coming for us.
Part 2. The Broken Tower. If you are afraid of ghosts, go sleep in a graveyard. A samurai axiom on conquering fear. Chapter 14. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The hunter waved her pack away, set herself, cocked her right leg, and with a cry of anger and effort, kicked savagely out at the door. Once, twice. On the third try, the melted security bolts and hinges gave up the fight, and the huge steel door leaned outward, teetered for a moment on one corner, then crashed down, sliding all the way down to the first landing. The hunter leaned far out over the rail and looked down. A group of people was clustered five levels down, all but one of them in white lab coats. The hunter adjusted the zoom function of her helmet and gasped. There she was. The witch. The mother of none. Abby Corman, the destroyer of countless worlds.
Go, bellowed the hunter. Kill the others. Leave the witch to me.
The pack lunged forward, racing down the steps and using the fallen door as a platform to jump over the rail and onto the next landing. They gathered speed, thundering down the flights of stairs, baying with bloodlust. Chapter 15. The Pierce Tower, 52nd floor. Dr. Arnold Benjamin crawled through the aluminum ducts for far too long. He had no idea where he was going and failed to get anywhere useful. There were spots where the duct dropped down to another floor, and so he slid down time and time again, but each time found himself in a maze that looked identical to the one he'd just left. He made too many right turns and then too many left ones, traveling without a plan and without allowing himself to be aware that he was in panic mode, fleeing like a rat in a maze and finding no way out. But he kept going, kept crawling. And if he wept while he crawled, so what? There was no one around to hear him. Chapter 16. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor.
Watch out!
Rosa screamed the warning, and they all recoiled as the pack came howling and screeching down the stairs. Riley and Burke headed to the next flight of stairs, clearly intending to flee, but from down below that eerie sound came again, that heavy, wet, obscene noise of something ponderous, moving its bulk as it waited in the shadows.
No! Cried Abby, shoving her phone into her pocket. Not that way!
Above them, the pack of alien animals snarled and howled, baying in their bizarre way. And with that, she took hold of the door to the analytics floor and jerked it open. It was dark in there, almost completely black, but that didn't matter.
There were, she knew, plenty of interior doors, plenty of places to hide. There would be more people and more phones. And at the other end, past yet another security door, was an elevator bank and the other fire tower. Abby grabbed Ji-woo and shoved her in, and then pushed the others into the dark. They struggled and protested, but she got them all inside, just as the first of the hunting creatures, moving much faster than the others, glared at her from the landing above. Its face was a weird cross between canine and feline, and yet its skin was like that of a lizard. The poor illumination from the stairwell light fell across its eyes and turned them an evil yellow. The creature wrinkled its muzzle and hissed at her. It reminded her of something from that classic Robert Johnson song, "Hellhound on My Trail." A hellhound. Though Hellcat was closer to it. God damn. Abby paused in the doorway and raised the axe, not to attack, but to show the creature. "I can bite too," she promised. The Hellcat leapt over the rail and hurled itself at her. Abby whirled, ran through the door, and slammed it shut just as the creature crashed into it with enough force to shake the door. Abby twisted the dial lock and then turned to find something to use as a blockade. She fumbled her phone out of her pocket and hit the flashlight app. A blue-white glow burst outward and outlined a wall of dark green leaves, hairy vines, and tendrils of dripping moss. Chapter 17. The Pierce Tower, the climb. David stared at the cell phone, which had gone dead in his hand.
"Oh my God, they're coming for us."
He stood there, holding on to the rope, battered by the frigid wind, trying to process everything Abby just told him. Parallel worlds. An alien hunter. His inner voice tried to tell him that this was beyond him, that there was nothing he could do, that he would fail if he tried. He'd fail himself, and he'd fail Abby. It whispered that he was too weak, past his prime, not good enough. It spoke. But by then, David was already moving. He was already climbing. Chapter 18. The Pierce Tower, 57th floor. The hunter followed, dragging the centipede with her down the stairs, following the baying of her pack. The loss of the youngest hound still stung. And with each step down, she tried to count the number of these wonderful and loyal creatures who'd given their lives for this hunt. They were not even from her own world. She'd first encountered them on one of the wilder and more violent Earths. Met, been attacked by them, killed a dozen of them, and tamed the rest of the pack. How many years ago was that now? She couldn't begin to guess. The members of her pack were grandsons and granddaughters of those first hounds. Easily hundreds of them had died along the way and been left on as many worlds. The matriarch was pregnant with a new litter. Gestation was 32 months, and she was just starting to show. The other females hadn't yet come into heat. The 9 remaining hounds were all that were left, and if they died, she would be alone. The thought nearly stopped her there on the steps. Alone. How long had she been alone before she'd met the hounds? Years. Of course, years. Ever since he had died. Her lover and companion, her champion, had died saving her. That had been an awful day. They had been so close. Or thought they had. They'd hunted an Abby Corman through a building very much like this. A long-running fight that had ended in an auxiliary control room. She and her lover thought they had their prey cornered, but the witch, that version of the Mother of None, had ambushed them. The hunter's lover had seen the trap as it was sprung and shoved the hunter out of the way. A final, desperate, reflexive act that cost him his life. The hunter nearly died with him, not from injury, but from the enormity of grief. She'd caught that Abby Corman moments later, caught her, beat her, forced her to shut down the threshold. And it did no good at all. It was so close, but not the actual prime world. It wasn't this world. The hunter knew for sure that this was the prime world, and this gateway was the one that had opened all of immeasurable infinity to the destructive power of a misfired threshold. This world, not the one where she'd found the pack, not the one where she'd lost her beloved, this one. And Abby Corman was behind the door where her remaining hounds clustered, snarling and growling. Would there be more losses? The hounds, though never named, were her children. The only children she would ever have, her family. Now that the man she loved was dust and bones on some distant reality. She reached the fallen door, grabbed the rail and vaulted over it, landing with a thud that sent pain through her joints. The armor buffered some of it, but not all. The hunter was a mass of healed bones, scar tissue, surgical wire, and pins. She felt all of her years, all of her battles. The pain, though, did not stop her or even slow her. It was the fuel that she ran on, fed on, needed. "I'm coming for you, mother of none," she said aloud. The pack faded away as she took the dead centipede and began smearing its remaining acid on the new door. Chapter 19. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. Abby froze for a few moments. Her body stopped, but her mind was working at the speed of an analytical computer. Time slowed, the way it does in shock, and her brain took each element, studied it, turning it this way and that until it made some kind of sense, but all so fast. Each second fractured into fragments, into splintered moments where all movement was nearly arrested, like a roaring fire captured in the forever of a high-definition photograph. So real you could almost feel the heat, but also separated from Abby's reality. It was as if her analytical mind was the only thing running at normal speed. One moment. Abby stared at the green impossibility of the room. Inside the analytics floor, some bizarre transformation had taken place, turning chairs and desks, workstations and banks of computers into a forest. No, that was wrong. A forest, as Abby remembered from a high school class ages ago, was composed of a dense growth of trees covering a large area of mostly dry land. The word jungle, while a precise scientific term, was used more often to describe a rainforest with very dense undergrowth, moist soil, and the presence of a great variety of vines, flowers, bogs, fungi, and a vast array of animal and insect life. They were damp, dense, thickly canopied forests with different kinds of plant life than those found in the woods in temperate regions like England and the American Northwest, or in this case, different from any kind of plants or animals found on Earth. On Abby's Earth, this Earth, stepping into that room was like stepping into another world, except it wasn't. Because through the thick tangle of vines and the leafy spread of unnamed plants, she could see those computers and desks and chairs. The impossible jungle was filled with bird calls she could not recognize, buzzing insects unlike anything she'd ever seen, and damp, leafed ferns, and other plants that she knew belonged in no living scientist's fossil record. Seeing those two realities, the jungle and the analytic center, so profoundly overlapped, meant that the fabric of reality was no longer cut from one cloth. The malfunctioning threshold had turned it into a patchwork quilt. The question was, is it permanent? Or can it be fixed? Another moment. Terror was a very real thing, and Abby realized with chilling clarity that she was caught among three impossible things. The hunter and her pack, whatever was down at the bottom of the stairwell, and this jungle filled with the unknown. A third moment. The others had gone into the room but were fanned out around her, each standing at the very edge of this jungle, each of them looking at her in horror, needing not to see their fear reflected in her eyes, needing her to be some kind of rock, some island of stability in a world that was falling apart, looking to her for leadership. Abby did not know what to say, though. What could she say? Nothing had really prepared her for this. How could anything in her life have done that? It was an absurd concept. Only the knowledge of what Gateway was and what the threshold was doing kept her from totally losing her mind. "I broke this," she told herself. "I need to fix this." It was neither true nor fair, but thinking it gave Abby something, a bit of strength, some clarity of vision, some sense of resolve. And those things, frail and incomplete as they were, kept her knees from buckling. They kept the screams pushed down inside her chest, and they kindled hope, although that was a tiny sputtering flame. A fourth moment. Collectively, less than 2 full seconds had elapsed, but it felt like longer because of how much new information there was, how much raw data. 2 small, fragile seconds in which their lives and everything in the world teetered. The door to the fire stairs shuddered as something hit it with incredible force. The hinges groaned in protest, gasping dust into the room. Beyond the door, there were snarls, deep and awful, as the Hellcats slammed into the door over and over. The doors had oak panels on either side of structural steel. The steel security bars kept the door pinned to the frame, but the whole frame itself seemed to be tearing away from the wall. Suddenly, time caught up to itself. Abby stared for 1 more second, and then she spun away, seeing Rosa and the others standing in the midst of a pathway through the jungle. She was aware that this trail was the aisle between workstations, but now the floor tiles were torn up, with exotic trees and grasses poking through holes and cracks. Far away, nearly lost in the distance, was the red plastic oblong with exit in glowing yellow letters. "Run!" she roared. They were still frozen in the immutability of their horror. But there was no time left for that. None. She ran at them, her axe in one hand, the other hand grabbing, shoving, driving them backward. "Make for the exit! Run! Run!" They stumbled, tripped over vines, collided into each other. But they ran. Abby ran too. There was something David had told her a while back, when she'd asked him how he could climb such deadly mountains. He'd said that it was no different from the first time he was in combat. "What kills you is the terror. People think they understand what terror is, but they don't. Until you're in that moment, you can't know. They've been frightened, even horrified. But terror itself is unique to the experience of the average person. It's massive. It looms up so big, so immediate, that you are forced to measure yourself against it. And in comparison, you are a tiny and utterly helpless thing. You don't know how to handle it because for nearly everyone, you've never had a reason to learn. Even soldiers, with all they go through in basic training, are not actually prepared for the first time the enemy comes howling at you from an ambush, guns firing, booby traps exploding, everyone around you caught in the same death trap. That's terror. But here's the thing, Abby. There's only one secret to dealing with terror. You move, freeze and die. Move, and 4 million years of human evolution are stripped away, and the lizard brain, that cold and pragmatic organ of survival, kicks in, juiced by one hell of a lot of adrenaline. If you keep moving, you have a chance. But unless you move, you have no chances at all. And if you move fast enough, the terror loses its grip on you. So, Abby ran. Chapter 20. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. Dr. Jacqueline Sloan stood flanked by the lab techs, Chan and Broussard, all three of them staring at the black mouth of the air vent duct. Her head still ached, but her thoughts were clearing as she focused on survival.
"He,"
began Broussard, but he was unable to finish the sentence.
"He just left us," said Chan. "I don't understand. Why would he do that?"
Sloan was horrified, outraged, but not surprised. She straightened and in the coldest voice in New York City said,
"Because he's a self-serving, spineless piece of shit. That's why."
The text gaped at her.
"No,"
protested Broussard. "He went for help."
"He'll be back," Chan assured her.
She gave them each about 3 seconds of frosty contempt.
"Jesus Christ," she muttered. "When you two idiots are done kissing Arnold Benjamin's ass, maybe we can..."
Her words cut off by a piercing scream from inside the gateway chamber. It rose and rose and rose, and then abruptly ended on a thick, wet note. Sloane felt her blood turn to ice.
"We have to get the fuck out of here."
"Where can we go?"
asked Chan, his eyes wide and wild with fear.
"Any damn place but right here. Arnold's a coward and a fool, but he had a plan."
With that, she reached toward the lip of the vent. Chapter 21. The Pierce Tower, 53rd floor. They ran, but the jungle did not want to let them pass. Vines crisscrossed the pathway, some slender as soda straws, others thicker than a man's wrist. The thinner vines were pale, translucent, the way some rare plants were, daggerwood and kidney ferns and Japanese skeleton flowers. The thickest ones were a sickly gray-green and wrapped in coarse, hairy fibers that glistened and rippled like the tentacles of sea anemones. Leaves of all shapes and sizes grew from shrubs and trees, flourishing with such density that it looked like simple compound leaves, undivided leaves, and palmately compound leaves all grew from the same stalks. There were spearblade leaves, ferns, spiked and smooth leaves, and all of it in a wild profusion of 10,000 shades of green. Some of the room's computers still glowed, their screens throwing enough blue-white light to pick out each difference in shade and tone. Creatures scuttled away from the running feet. Small lizards with armor like cockroaches, scorpions with 2, 3, or even 4 curling stingers. Blind rodents with brilliant red spiky hair. A bird with a beak like a toucan, but a splash of hideous spider eyes, crouched atop a file cabinet, and shrieked at them in a voice like a terrified child. A long time ago, when she was a freshman in college, Abby had gone down to the Laredo region of Peru with some friends, and spent a few days at a camp run by a shaman. Each of the travelers had tried ayahuasca, a psychoactive brew made from the leaves of the Psychotria viridis shrub, along with the stalks of the Banisteriopsis caiapa vine. Each of them had a deeply hallucinogenic experience that ranged from mildly trippy to extremely mind-altering. For Abby, it seemed to rupture the fabric of her analytical mind in ways that invited in all manner of nightmare images. The first experience shook her so badly that she refused to partake again, and the lingering effect was troubling nightmares populated with creatures out of a surreal Salvador Dali painting, or maybe the mad dreamings of Hieronymus Bosch. This was like that, only worse because of its profound and inarguable reality. Everyone in her group was freaking out, jumping at movement, crying out in horror and disgust, panic rising in their voices, and there was nothing Abby could do except try to herd them toward the exit. But none of this made sense. How could the effects of the faulty threshold have shifted the reality way down here? How could it be reshaping the world outside, as David had described it? The gateway was built according to logic and science, and even though she and the other scientists of the Gateway Initiative had pioneered a new branch, interdimensional physics, or IDP, there was nothing in any study to suggest this kind of dimensional spillover was possible. Nothing. Not even a hint of it. What had Benjamin and Sloan done? How had they caused this? Or was the fault really her own? Up ahead, Burke was now within 12 yards of the exit.
"We're going to make it,"
Abby thought, as desperate hope blossomed in her chest. Burke smashed through leaves and brush, bashing everything aside with his meaty forearms.
"The door's open," cried Burke. "I can see."